This series includes brief but graphic mention of suicide. It also discusses domestic violence, child abuse, and other forms of violence, and drug use. Listener discretion is advised. If you're experiencing domestic violence, you can reach out for support in the U.S. to 800-799-SAFE. This is The Fall Line. We're back in Nashville for this series, at the edges of its music scene. Los Angeles and New York aren't the only cities people head to when they have dreams of making it big. In the Southeast, there's Atlanta, of course, but Nashville, Tennessee has its own draw. It has for decades. Country dreams are built up on stories of Music City, USA. Now, country music may not have been born in Nashville, but by the 70s, it was a serious industry. And by the late 1980s, when our story begins, the city had settled into its role as an entertainment powerhouse. When we brought you our series on the disappearance of Ricky Franks, we told you about Nashville's fanfare, the multi-day musical extravaganza that's now known as the CMA Fest, the Country Music Artists Festival. Nashville's website calls the city the songwriting capital of the world. And country music certainly dominated the radio waves in the 1980s and the stages of the Ryman or the Bluebird Cafe and led hopefuls to Music Row. Now, as then, live music is everywhere, spilling out onto Broadway to pull those tourists in. In 1985, when a man named Patrick Allen Guild arrived in town, he was one of an endless stream of hopefuls who thought he might make it big in a city with so much room for music. But things didn't work out that way. Pat, as he was called, was originally from Arizona. He was in his late 20s when he came to Nashville, and he was described as a white male, over 6 feet tall, with brown hair and blue eyes. He always had some kind of facial hair, a full mustache or a beard, and Pat had at least one tattoo, a Yosemite Sam tattoo that was high on his right forearm. We aren't sure when he got it, because it's not apparent in many family photos, but he did have it by November of 1989 when he was profiled in the Tennessean newspaper. You can see the edges of the ink peeking out under one shirt sleeve. Pat Guild had reportedly worked as a pipe fitter back in Arizona, but he left that behind when he moved southeast. He came to Nashville with a goal, to establish himself as a songwriter. But he had trouble making inroads in that industry. Pat wanted to sell his songs to the big country music publishers, but like so many others, he didn't make it as quickly or as easily as he'd hoped. He managed to schedule meetings, but those contracts just didn't come. And according to police reports and local media, Pat had trouble finding steady work and stable housing. Per his own account, Pat spent several years living near the bank of the Cumberland River in an encampment then known as Tent City. There are many metro areas with semi-permanent or permanent encampments that have that nickname. And from what we can tell, most of the residents of that camp didn't call it that, but the name was omnipresent in the local press coverage. According to the Tennessean, Nashville's encampment was established a year or two before Pat arrived in town. We found an article in the paper that profiled a then 34-year-old man named Bill Hardin, who actually founded that settlement. It was published in April of 1985, a month before Pat Guild moved to Nashville. And per the Tennessean, Bill had been living with a group of friends, quote, across the river from the Metro Courthouse for about 5 months. By the time Pat got there in May, things were well established. The location of the camp was described as next to the I-24-I-40 overpass near the Cumberland River. There's been a near-continuous settlement in that area for almost 40 years, though floods and city efforts have destroyed or removed the semi-permanent housing that was in place when Pat joined the camp. The camp was essential housing for its residents, most of whom were working and living in tents, sharing a communal, quote, outdoor living room between their individual sleeping spaces. The Tennessean spoke with another resident who, at the time of the article's writing, was setting up a living area for himself and his wife. Apparently, the couple both planned to leave their current apartment. As he told the paper, "We want to save some money, and we can't do that paying rent." When the camp leader Bill Hardin was asked about interactions with law enforcement, he said the residents had been given a few cautions, including not climbing the bridge and not entering a nearby impound yard. Bill Hardin said that their community handled its own conflicts and that if someone didn't get along with the other residents, quote, they were asked to leave. Hardin also said that the encampment just wasn't sufficient for everyone in the coldest months of winter, when most residents left for local shelters to seek protection from the extreme weather. But it served a vital purpose in a city where, in the 1980s, it was hard to make ends meet if one was facing employment instability or other issues. Hardin told the Tennessean, "You can't make any money from working for labor pools." And another man, Billy Krister, added, "I came here from Little Rock because I was offered a job, but that fell through. Now I'm trying to get enough money together to go back to California, where my mother lives." That same encampment Bill Hardin began in 1984 remains today in a different form. Detective Matthew Filter of the Metro Nashville PD told us that much of the encampment was destroyed in the 2010 Nashville floods, but based on media reports, it's clear that the area is still being used for shelter. After all, like many other metro areas, Nashville is a very expensive place to live, one of the most expensive in the Southeast. And as the Nashville Scene pointed out in 2021, housing vouchers don't solve that issue because there's not enough real estate and too few landlords who actually take the vouchers. There's that, and now residents without permanent housing are facing another issue. Per CNN, quote, "Across Tennessee, pitching a tent on public land outside of designated campsites is now a felony offense." But when Pat Guild was living there in the mid to 1980s, the mood seemed different. The encampment at Cumberland River had been profiled a number of times in local media, and residents had been able to erect semi-permanent housing and even small cabins. There was another article in the Tennessean in November of 1989 that highlighted Pat's contributions to those building efforts. The article, titled "Off the Streets, in Search of a Home," features a photo of Pat. That's the same piece that showed us a glimpse of his tattoo in the featured photo. According to the Tennessean, after Pat arrived in Nashville, he spent 8 months living without any shelter at all. And that's the focus of this article: the house that Pat built for himself in the camp that Bill Hardin began, and his experience with housing instability in the city. At the time he was spotlighted, Pat was performing in a play about homelessness, and he was also working with the Nashville Street Poets. The article shows Pat sitting in front of a very small cabin. It looks much like the tiny houses that are so popular today, and it's tucked up under a highway overpass. Pat described the cabin, which he built himself in 2 weeks from scrap metal, to the Tennessean. Quote, "It's a shelter, a stepping stone along the way, but it's better than living on the street or in a mission." We've included a photo of Pat in front of the cabin on our social media. You can see there that it has windows and a door and awnings, and the Tennessean notes that he also constructed, quote, "an outhouse and a brick grill." "I'm proud of the whole cabin," Pat told the Tennessean. He'd furnished it with, quote, "a small sleeper sofa and a recliner," and he'd also set up a wood stove inside to keep the space heated. Pat explained that the smoke from the stove meant that he had to bathe, quote, "in a nearby stream every day, even in winter, to get the smell out of his hair." He washed his clothes there, too. The Tennessean asked Pat about his employment, and he said, "It took me 2 years to talk myself into moving. I had to sell my tools to move, and you can't get a job as a pipe fitter without tools." He said that he spent his time working a few days a week so he could concentrate on pitching songs to Nashville publishers. He wasn't ready to give up on Nashville just yet. Pat said that he just wanted stable housing, a truck, and maybe a little land, somewhere he could take his dog, Bullet, who was living with him at the river camp. And that's one version of Pat Guild, the dreamer, hoping to make it in Music City. And there's another version of his life, too, told from the perspective of the people who knew him, and from his oldest daughter, Shannon, who's worked hard to gather the bare details of his life. We all exist like that. Depending on perspective, who is seeing us and when, we are different people. Pat Guild in The Tennessean is a resourceful person and hopeful, sympathetic. And to the mothers of his children, he was someone else. And his daughter Shannon has spent more than 2 decades piecing together these versions of her father's life, trying to discover where he slipped between the cracks. As far as we know, Pat Guild continued living in that cabin for another 2 years or so after that 1989 article was published. He never made it in songwriting, and after December of 1991, there were no more official signs of him, and no unofficial signs either. Not in the papers, or contact made with family, or with the 2 children he had in the decade before he disappeared. And he didn't have bills in his name, or the kind of paper trail that makes a search for an adult who disappeared before the digital age more manageable. We can't say for sure that Pat Guild didn't just move, nor change his name, or both. But there's reason to believe that something may have happened to him in Nashville. And one of his children wants to know where her father is. Shannon doesn't remember him. Her mother fled for safety while she was still a toddler. But Shannon has always had questions, and as she's gotten older, the need for more answers is pressing. Her mother has answered as much as she can, but Shannon's mother moved before Pat Guild ever headed for Nashville, and she did her best not to know about his life there. But she was always honest with her daughter about who her father was, and she shared the information that she did have. And as Shannon got older and reached out to Pat's family, she found out that no one had heard from him in years. So Shannon began to pursue all those possible threads. Did her father leave town on his own accord? Did he die of natural causes? Was there an accident or even foul play? Wherever the evidence leads, Shannon is determined to find out. But that's the trouble with a missing persons case that's more than 30 years old. There just isn't much evidence to go on. Shannon is one of those family members who, in their own way, become investigators into their relatives' cold cases. She has put in countless hours tracing names and dates and old addresses across the internet in search of answers. Shannon has dug up records that have impressed law enforcement. And Shannon got pretty far. But she's never actually been to Nashville. She's just heard stories of a father who had a dream and who headed there. And she's heard other stories, too, that he was violent, that he frightened her mother, that he also experienced violence, that he experienced a brutal trauma in his adolescence that changed the course of his life, that he had issues with alcohol and drug dependency. She found out that Pat had a second child about a year before he disappeared off the radar, and she found out that that child's mother had been frightened, too. She'd been granted an emergency order of protection and said the last time she saw Pat Guild, he was walking down those courthouse steps. And Shannon listened to those stories. She paid attention. But when she turned 18, she still decided that she'd try and find Pat to gain what she describes as a sense of closure. So, as we said, she reached out to Pat's family. And that part wasn't difficult, because Shannon's mother had kept up some contact there. And Shannon discovered, as we said, that they hadn't heard from him since 1991 either. And she also found out that he'd had a difficult relationship with them, too. Shannon told us that no one had been looking for him, or even filed a report. Like Shannon's mother, Shannon feels they had their reasons why. Shannon has her reasons, too. But ultimately, the need to know, to really know, what happened to Patrick Allen Guild has pushed her to pursue his case. And as an adult, she's done so much more formally. she's been able to open a missing persons investigation in Nashville with Detective Matthew Filter, who brought Pat's case to us. That investigation, which has been active since 2018, it's been difficult. But they have gathered enough information that, with your help, Shannon may finally get the resolution that she's been seeking. Brooke and Shannon spoke early this year, and Shannon started by telling us about her early life, moves from California to Florida to up north, and what she was told about her parents' relationship and her father when she was young.
I live in Connecticut. My mother was born and raised here. And when she graduated from high school, she took off out west. She went to Arizona to go to college. And that's where she met Pat. So I was born in Arizona. And my mom only lived in Arizona for about 3 years, I'd say, maybe 4 years at the most. I think she left Connecticut in 78, I want to say, the year she graduated. And she was in Arizona. She went to college there, and that's where she met Pat. And she was in Arizona until like 83. So she was in Arizona for about 5 years. And then she relocated to Southern California when I was about 2 years old. I was born in 1981. And she was married to Pat for a brief time in Arizona. And then she moved to Southern California in 1983. And we lived there until 1993. She met him through one of his cousins, I believe. And I don't know if the cousin went to college with her or she met at like the local bar. I have no idea where she met the cousin, but she met him through his cousin. One of my mom's younger sisters also dated one of Pat's brothers for a brief period of time.
From what Shannon understands, Pat was known to be charming, but also volatile. He was described as emotionally and physically combative as a teen. He may have been dealing with undiagnosed PTSD as well. Now, we would never offer a diagnosis for someone, but as you'll hear from Shannon in the following clip, he went through an incredibly traumatic experience when he was an adolescent. She does not view that as an excuse for the behavior he exhibited as an adult, but she thinks it's important context.
Pat has a lot of mental health issues from what I'm learning. From what I know, when Pat was 15, and I've heard this from my mom and from his brother, Johnny, when Pat was 15 years old, he found his father who had committed suicide. So I'm sure that is, you know, probably part of where his mental illness comes in. I'm sure it, you know, plays a huge part of it. But yeah, he found his father with a gunshot wound to the head at 15 years old. So, I mean, he's got a lot of issues from what I know. He was very, very physically abusive, and not just to my mom, to everybody around him. And that's why she got out of the relationship, because he had physically harmed her so many times that apparently the courts told her, because she kept trying to get restraining orders on him and restraining orders. And the judge, I guess, looked at her and was like, lady, if you don't leave, we're going to find you dead. She's a little tiny lady. And Pat is like 6'2". So, you know, when she left, that was pretty much the end of it. I thought she had cut off ties from his family, but I think there was a little bit where she would kind of try to keep in contact with his mother here and there, but it was very few and far between the time. And then the thing was, she wanted to get divorced from him, but when you go through a divorce, you have to leave a lot of your information. And she never wanted a paper trail, because she never wanted him to be able to find her. So that's why the contact was like very, very minimal, I guess, even with his mother. He was mean to his own mother. He was, you know, mean to his siblings. And just not a nice person, but at the end of the day, that doesn't curb my wanting to still have an answer. You know what I mean? It just, I still want to look for him. I still want an answer. There's no closure without that.
Shannon only has a little background on why Pat decided to move to Nashville, but she knows that it was a long-standing dream of his. We don't know if he'd always had a lot of love for country music, but we know he was passionate about songwriting.
My mom said the whole time she was married to him, he always tried to get her to go to Nashville. He wanted to live in Nashville. He thought he was like a singer songwriter type thing. He was going to make it big. Basically, was that he was very involved in music and wanted to be involved in the music industry. My mom said, "I'm not going to Nashville. There's nothing there for me." I guess after my mom left him when she left Phoenix to go to Southern California in like 1986, so like 3 years later, he left Phoenix and went to Nashville.
We've told you what the Tennessean newspaper gathered on Pat's time in Nashville, that he slept unsheltered for close to a year, and then moved to the camp near the I-24 overpass. According to Pat's own account, he was spending most of that time trying to sell songs and working a few days a week to afford essentials. But something else we learned from Shannon and Detective Filter's research was that Pat had gotten into a serious relationship in Nashville. To our knowledge, he and his partner were living together at the I-24 encampment when she got pregnant. They had a daughter 6 months after that Tennessean article was published. Shannon had a half-sister that she learned about several years after the girl was born.
I think she was born in 1990. So I was 9, but my mom didn't tell me about her till I was probably like 15. So, I mean, I did find out, I think I was a freshman in high school, and my mom was like, Pat has another kid, just so you know, like, you do have another sibling out there or whatever. But she didn't really know much.
That news came to Shannon's mother from Pat's family. According to police files, his partner experienced domestic violence in their relationship, and she sought out an emergency order of protection from the Nashville court system. Their child was still a baby when that order was granted. According to Metro Nashville police files, Pat's then-partner reported the abuse was tied or exacerbated by alcohol use and was allegedly experienced by both herself and her infant. After the order was granted, she didn't see Pat again, though she remained in Nashville for another full decade. Now, all this information didn't come to Shannon all at once. Her mother told her what she could, but as the internet advanced, much of it was uncovered by Shannon herself, just bit by bit. Shannon first made direct contact with Pat's relatives when she was a teen, and they were able to give her some of the background. Then later, when she found Pat's other daughter, she learned a little more. And there's this. Many people involved in this story have changed their names for personal safety reasons, and that made Shannon's search even harder. But Shannon still managed to connect. In terms of her paternal family, here's what Shannon told us.
They're just like, "Oh, you remind us of Pat. You look like Pat. We remember you when you were a baby." But very vague. He's been gone so long that Debbie, his one sister, she had 3 kids by the time she was 19 years old. So she was off already living her own life. I found out about the daughter when I was, a freshman in high school, about 15 years old. And then I kind of was just like, "Oh, that's kind of cool," but I was 15. So what did I know? And when I was like 18, when I graduated high school, was the first time I probably really put in trying to look for him. But that's when the internet was just starting to like become a thing. I graduated high school in 1999. So like, even then, it wasn't like a broad thing like it is now, where you have all this information at your fingertips. So I had looked for him when I turned 18, but I like didn't really have a lot of information. Last I knew, he was living homeless in Nashville, but it was like a short-lived thing. And then you know, I kind of just let it go. And then when I had kids of my own, I had my first son when I was 22, I gave it some thought again, because then you have your own kids and it's just like a, oh, it's kind of like a triggering thing, I guess. You want to really know like where you came from. And I looked again and I just came up empty handed. And then in 2011, I want to say, I went crazy and I was just like so determined to try to find him. And at this point, you know, I had good resources with the internet. It was, you know, very up and coming. By 2011, there was, you know, the internet was a fully in effect. So I spent like a year trying to find him, like day and night, hours and hours and hours and hours. And without doing the actual legwork, I just kept coming up empty-handed.
Shannon did have some documentation to work with, which was sent to her by Pat's mother.
She sent me a bunch of pictures and all the paperwork she has on him, his birth certificate, his social security card, his baptism papers, all of his report cards throughout the years, a ton of pictures. She sent me all kinds of stuff.
That gave her access to a few essential items that she could use to track him, like a social security number and the items that she'd later share with police. Because Pat had such a small official footprint, she found herself circling back to stories and gathering the contextual information that she could use to widen her search.
My mom, even though she was only with Pat for a short amount of time, she's always been very forthcoming because she knows how important it is to me to like just have an answer at the end of the day, whether it's he's deceased or whatever. I just want the closure. So she's always helped try to help me find him and provide me with any information that she has. Again, she was only with him for a very short time, maybe 3 or 4 years, but she put me in contact with his mother because luckily his mother still lived in the same general area. For me, the connection, it was like a strong yearning once I had kids, because it almost gave me like a, you know, now you're having, these are your genes and your DNA. And you just, I feel like you wonder where you come from when you have kids. It just puts a lot more into perspective.
Shannon is just not sure of how much of Pat's story of his life in Nashville, what he told the Tennessean, is actually true. He was certainly performing in a play, just like the article said, but she doesn't know how many meetings he was actually taking with song publishers or whether he'd actually done any consistent work down there as a pipe fitter. This is mostly context that she needs to help her understand who Pat may have been associating with on a day-to-day basis, as she's looked for clues as to what might have happened to him.
I think that from what I've heard of Pat and his personality, he can portray himself like he's bigger than life. So what he's portraying, is that really the truth? I always second guess everything and, you know, I question everything. So just because what he's saying in the article doesn't necessarily have me believing that that's, you know, he tries to make it sound like he's this pipe fitter and all this stuff. That's not even true, I don't think. My mom's like, he was never a pipe fitter. My mom's like, he never even really held a job. So because he had substance abuse problems. She's like, he couldn't hold a job and he has severe anger management, you know, problems.
Shannon feels that those problems are what kept other people, acquaintances and his family, from seeking out answers when Pat fell out of contact.
His last known whereabouts in 91, nobody looked for him until I looked for him in like 2000. When I really, really started looking, like 2010, 11, 12, somewhere around there, you know, so, and I didn't file a missing persons report until like 2017 or 18. So you're talking years and years that have went by before there was ever even any acknowledgement of the fact that he was missing. It's not like he went missing and then, 3 days later or 3 months or 3 years, someone was like, hey, this guy's missing. Like, we should probably, file a report. No, it was years and years and years before his name ever came up again when I started looking. How does a detective now try to backtrack that? You know what I'm saying? Like, how does he even go back to 1991 and say, hey, well, let's try to retrace steps? No, it's been 20 some odd years. How do you retrace steps? The topography of Nashville probably doesn't even look the same after that amount of time. So I filed a case with Namath, or I tried to, and Namath said they wouldn't open a case without a legal missing persons report. And that's where I got put in contact with Detective Filter. So I filed a missing persons report with him. I want to say it was 2018, but I'm not 100% sure on that. The detective he does whatever he can, but because the case is so old, how do you backtrack a case from, 25 years ago? I've given him all this information. I have written to like Oprah multiple times. Back in the day, there was all those talk shows, and you could write to them and try to get on. And I'd done all of that, and just nothing ever came to fruition, basically.
When Shannon began to work with Detective Matthew Filter, they pulled their information so he could open an investigation into Pat's disappearance.
I got involved in this case September 26, 2018. I got a call from the regional administrator with the National Missing and Unidentified Person System, NAMIS for short. And they were requesting help getting a missing persons report filed on Patrick Guild. Pat's daughter, Shannon, who was living in Connecticut at the time, had reached out to Namath requesting help in trying to track down her dad. And they had a lot of unidentified remains that they thought were good matches for Patrick Guild. And they needed to collect DNA from the family, but Namath couldn't open up a case unless there was an official missing persons report on file with law enforcement. I called Shannon, and she explained to me that she had been looking for her dad for about the last 7-8 years, and she last determined that he was in Nashville, Tennessee. She had tried to file a missing persons report, but our department policy was that we don't take missing persons reports from people outside of the city. The report, you had to come to the city to make the report. And the main reason for that was because we required a signature on the missing persons report to satisfy NCIC entry requirements. But I told Shannon that I would do a little bit of research, and if I could verify that he was in fact last in Nashville, I would see what we could do to maybe help her along or get some kind of a report on file so Namath could get involved. So I started doing a little bit of research on Patrick Gill, just looking for signs of life, looking for any indications that he had died, moved on somewhere. I couldn't find anything at all on him. No signs of life, no death records. But what I did find was that he appeared to have been living in Nashville in late 1991, maybe early 1992, at the time he disappeared. So I got with my sergeant and explained to him the circumstances involving the case, and that I was able to verify that Patrick Gill was most likely in Nashville, Tennessee at the time he disappeared, and he gave me authorization to make an out-of-town report. That's how the case got started. I basically started this case like I would any other missing persons case, and that's just gathering as much information about the victim as I can, or developing a victimology on the person, which I had actually acquired all that information and did the majority of the research even before the missing persons report was filed. So I was already well on my way with that aspect. And of course, I had already searched for any life, pattern to life, signs of life that he had moved on, was living somewhere else, tried to track him down if he had maybe changed his name or something. Couldn't find anything regarding that. And as I had said before, I couldn't find anything regarding death records either that told me that he had died at any point or in some other location. So the only thing I was able to do after that was to start tracking down people that he was acquainted with back then.
It was among those threads of connection in which Detective Filter found possible leads, rumors, the hints of rumors as to what might have become of Patrick Allen Guild. But he and Shannon need more information if they're to solidify those leads into the resolution that Shannon is looking for. Because, as she told us, it's the not knowing that eats at her. And whatever the answer is, the conclusion to Pat's story, whether he's moved on somewhere else or something's happened to him, she just wants to know. And based on what Detective Filter has uncovered, it is very possible that a homicide investigation may be opened, given that the proper information just comes in. Next time on The Fall Line, we dig deeper into Pat Guild's last year in Nashville, what Detective Filter uncovered, and the link Shannon has gone to in the last few years to seek other possible avenues of connection, and how your information may help in her search. Patrick Pat Allen Guild was last seen in late 1991. At the time of his disappearance, he was described as a 32-year-old white male with brown hair and blue eyes. He usually had a beard or mustache. Pat was between 6 feet and 6 foot 4 inches tall and 140 to 175 pounds. He's described as having a scar beside his right eye and a tattoo of the Warner Brothers character Yosemite Sam on his right arm. Per the Charlie Project, Pat's nose has been broken several times. If you or anyone you know has any information, please reach out to Metro Nashville Police. You can contact Detective Filter at Metro Nashville at 615-862-7803. You can also call Nashville Crime Stoppers at 615-74-CRIME, that's 615-742-7463. In that case, callers remain anonymous and qualify for a cash reward. If you know of a case that should be covered on The Fall Line, there's a link to the case submission form in our show notes. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is an independently produced show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And please take a moment to rate and review our show in your podcast app of choice. If you're interested in pre-ordering my book, which covers a year of my life working on a Jane Doe case in the world of forensic scientists who resolve unidentified persons cases, you can find a link in our show notes. The book is called Lay Them to Rest, and it's out this October. If you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to pay for the Milbrook Twins billboard and to fund therapy for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes for $5 a month. We also have occasional video live streams and blogs, which all patrons can enjoy starting at just a dollar. If you prefer Apple Premium, we've begun that feed as well, so you have an alternative way to contribute. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Warders, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrill. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove, produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Liz Lipka and Sarah Turney. As of November 2022, our monthly donations are going to Season of Justice to support their testing and family grant initiatives.